This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new high-tech scooter, known as the Segway Human Transporter, will be available to consumers starting in March. Most people seem to agree it's a pretty cool invention. Yet there's a lot of worry surrounding its use. The company that manufactures the Segway is lobbying for the right to use it on sidewalks, and 33 states have passed legislation allowing that. But many pedestrian and senior citizen groups are worried that these vehicles could collide with pedestrians, causing serious injuries. A little later, we'll hear from one of the activists who led the campaign banning the Segway from the sidewalks of San Francisco. First, we're going to hear from the Segway's inventor, Dean Kamen. Until the Segway, he was best known for his medical inventions, including a portable insulin pump, a kidney dialysis machine for home use, a heart stent, and a motorized wheelchair that can climb stairs. We'll talk about some of these inventions later, but let's start with the Segway. I asked Dean Kamen to describe what it looks like and how it works.
The best way to describe how it works or how it feels is like a pair of magic sneakers. It looks like a low platform about 6 inches high on which you stand, and there's a small shaft, a handle comes up, which ends up looking like the handles of a bicycle. And you have two wheels, but instead of like a bicycle where they're one in front and one in back, each one is just outside your left and right foot. So when you first look at it, you'd say, this thing must be unstable. It's missing either its front or rear axle. But in the platform that you're standing on, there are a set of 5 gyroscopes that are sensing any kind of motion, acceleration, tilt of the platform, and they feed 9 different computers, lots of information in real time, and those computers send signals out to the wheels in such a way that if the machine were even very slightly tipped forward, the wheels would run under it forward. If the machine were tilted backward, they would run backward.
When you were researching this Segway and figuring out what the computers and the gyroscopes needed to do, did you, like, walk a lot and try to analyze what your body was doing as you were walking?
Well, actually, it's even more than that. The Segway really comes from a medical product that I worked on for more than 10 years. I've literally spent my entire adult life working on medical products. And one that we started many, many, many years ago was a product that I thought would be a way to give the disabled population a capability that virtually no product addresses. Those people, whether they're in wheelchairs because they have no capability to move their legs, or if they're in a wheelchair or using a walker or any other device because of whether it's Parkinson's disease or MS, we find ways to move those people around, but what they've lost is the ability that we all take for granted to do something uniquely human called walking. And so the more I looked at wheelchairs and how to improve them, the more I got frustrated. I mean, I could make a wheelchair climb stairs. You could make it look like a bulldozer or a tank. But finally, after years of being frustrated that we couldn't really do what we thought needed to be done, it suddenly occurred to us why. And that is, what they lost was the specific way to move around by standing up and balancing and having a small footprint and being with their colleagues in conversation eye to eye. And so we said, you know, let's not improve the wheelchair. Let's figure out how to restore effectively human balance. And that set me on a 10-year expedition into understanding this very subtle and, frankly, from an engineering point of view, very difficult process of understanding balance and walking. We did it. We built a device called an iBot, which literally allows a disabled person to cruise down the hallway at eye level with their peers, balanced on 2 wheels the way their peers are balanced on their feet. It allows them to go step up and down curbs and literally walk up and down stairs. And we spent so much time trying to understand and finally succeeding in understanding how humans ambulate and balance and walk that we realized we could take the same technology and apply it to the Segway and make this technology available to the rest of the population.
So getting back to the actual design of the Segway, how do you steer it and how do you adjust the speed of it?
Forward and back, there's no clutch, there's no brakes, there's no throttle, there's no accelerator, there's no gear shift. There is only one control on the whole machine. And in your left hand, almost like the throttle would be on a motorcycle, there's a rotating member. And if you rotate it to the left, like a little steering wheel, the machine turns to the left. If you rotate it to the right, the machine turns to the right. That is the only control on the machine. And when you combine that wrist coordination with your thinking forward, thinking stop, or thinking backwards, after a little while, you literally can dance around a room. If you were just here, I would just put you on the machine, and you would cruise down the hall, you would turn around, you would come back to me smiling, and when you got back to me, you would just stop.
No,
you wouldn't know how you stopped. You'd just stop, and you'd smile, and you'd say, I get it.
Are you saying that because the gyroscopes and the computers are very complicated, and you couldn't explain how they work any easier than you could explain how our brains
work? Yeah, the way the gyros work, I could explain very easily. Imagine that the gyroscope, and there's a bunch of them, and they're redundant, so if something happens to one of them, it doesn't affect the performance or safety of the machine. But a gyroscope is sitting there, for instance, one of them is vertical, and it always wants to be vertical. And if you stand on this platform, and since it only has two wheels and they're side by side, any subtle motion of your body that puts your center of mass in front of the point of contact of those wheels would start to tip the platform forward. Everybody's familiar with that concept. That's why when they look at this machine, they're so familiar with that concept, they say, my God, it'll fall over. But as soon as it starts to tip by any amount, the gyros sense that tip. They send information to the computers. The computers look at how much it's tipping, how much the rate of change of tipping is either increasing or decreasing, and how much the rate of change of the rate of change, in other words, the position, the velocity, and the acceleration of that platform are all being measured in real time very, very frequently. And as a function of how much tip there is, those computers determine how much power to send to the motors so that the motors will torque those wheels to run in the direction of the tip so that they will return it to being vertical while they move. And so as you get on this machine, you never really feel a tipping, but if you kind of start to lean forward as if you were doing what you naturally do to take a step, those motors will just make those wheels move you forward while the platform appears to you to not have leaned over very much. If you decide I don't want to go any further, your natural instinct is to kind of lean back, and as soon as you lean back, the platform senses or the gyro sense that the platform is now leaning back, it takes the torque away from the motors and stop it or, in fact, move it backwards.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dean Kamen, and he is the inventor of the Segway. Now, a lot of pedestrian groups are very concerned about the Segway, and San Francisco has banned the Segway on city streets. The concerns include that a motorized vehicle on sidewalks or pedestrians walk can be threatening to pedestrians, particularly the elderly, people who are frail, people whose walking is impaired, people whose hearing is impaired, and they might not notice that there's a vehicle behind them. But really, any pedestrian walking down the street could conceivably be injured by a heavy, you know, motorized scooter or vehicle, whatever you'd want to call it. So what's your argument for on behalf of allowing Segways on sidewalks of city streets?
Well, first I'd like to say you said that they were, I think the word you used was banned from the streets of San Francisco. Actually, I believe they're just fine on the streets of San Francisco. What we had attempted to do...
I meant sidewalks.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Once we were able to make a device that moves like a pedestrian, stops like a pedestrian, can spin in place and do pirouettes better than most people except maybe a ballerina, we had a device that has a footprint as small as a pedestrian. It leaves you at eye level with other people. Your hands, again, it would be much easier to have this discussion with you or anybody if you had some experience with the machine. But once a person uses it and sort of adopts it as an extension of themselves, it becomes pretty clear to anybody on it that you certainly wouldn't want to be out in the street in front of a bus. You're standing there, you're backing up, you're spinning around like any other pedestrian. You're just a little bit more empowered.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Say you're walking down the street, you know, and I'll just speak for myself here. I'm usually walking down the street oblivious because I'm thinking about something and I'm not necessarily thinking about where I am or what's going on around me. And then I might suddenly stop and say, did I bring my keys? You know, right. And suddenly I've stopped. I'm checking for my keys. Say there's a Segway right behind me that's going three times the speed that I'm walking. The Segway won't necessarily be able to stop as quickly as I've stopped. So, I mean, that's a kind of, I think, typical pedestrian concern.
I think that is the typical pedestrian concern, and that's why I think we need to educate people and let them experience this. Because, in fact, if somebody were behind you and you were walking along on a crowded sidewalk and they were behind you, they wouldn't be going three times as fast as you. And if you were to stop, your natural instinct to stop, even if you suddenly stopped quickly, their natural instinct would be about the same, and the stopping distances from the same speeds are about the same. I can simply tell you that in 100,000 hours of use now on the sidewalks, there's been no such occurrence.
But, you know, here's the thing. It's a little difficult to judge from experiences to this point because how many people have Segways? So if there's a Segway being used on a sidewalk, it might be the only Segway in town. If it really catches on and there's lots of people in city sidewalks using the Segway, then the whole nature of pedestrian traffic patterns starts to change.
And frankly, we hope you're right. And again, we've thought about that for many years. The first thing I would say is I agree with you. We don't have a lot of experience. And the only way to get experience with any new thing is to be open-minded and try it. And all we have been doing as we go around the country trying to show people what this option might do for them is to have them say, let's try it. But I would also tell you that as we gain experience and see that they mix well with pedestrians, to your question, which was what happens when there's a lot of them, I guess there's many answers. But if it turns out that there are not going to be a lot of them, then this isn't an issue worth anybody's big concern. If it turned out there would be a lot of them, then what will happen is the infrastructure will make appropriate adjustments.
What was your first invention?
As a little kid, I was always frustrated that my mother, like everybody's mother, would tell me to make my bed in the morning. And when you're not much taller than the mattress, it takes a lot of trips running completely around the bed to get the cover up on one side and then up an even amount on the other side. And then at night, you tend to muss it all up. So it occurred to me that if I attached a pulley to each corner of the blanket and tied the other two corners at the foot of the bed to the rails, then in the morning, if the pulleys at the two top corners were properly organized, I could just take a rope, pull it, and the cover would immediately spring to its normal condition of a, quote, made bed. So it dramatically reduced the trauma of having to do that.
Your mother must have thought you were crazy.
I had very, very understanding parents.
So how long did you use this bed-making system?
Oh, my guess is until the novelty wore off, but I guess what was good about that experience to me was the idea that you could see a problem, think about a solution, some abstract idea, then with a couple of tools, you could reduce that abstract idea to some physical reality that solved the problem. And although I don't think there'd be a big commercial opportunity in bed makers, it sort of gave me a sense through the rest of my life that you look at the world, you find things that ought to be done differently to get a better outcome, and then you use more sophisticated tools than I had back then, like physics and engineering, and you reduce those abstract ideas to real products that help real people have a better life.
What was the first invention you sold?
The first invention I sold were I guess today you'd call them light organs, or it was, as I was in high school, the world of semiconductors was exploding, and instead of transistors being able only to produce small amounts of power, for instance, to move the speakers in your headset, they made huge advances to where they could control thousands of watts. I think personally that was the birth of the disco is the result of the world of semiconductors. But you could take the output of that little amplifier that was running your speakers, run it through some of these kinds of new transistors called triacs and SCRs, and you could literally have the whole room, all the powered lights in the room, respond like music. I recognize that kids would like to do that in bands in these early days, and I started building equipment that would let them build light shows. I then started using the same equipment to run much more sophisticated light shows, and in fact built the equipment that ran the Museum of Natural History Hayden Planetarium light show pretty much when I was in high school and going into college, and then started building boxes like that to run other museum shows and industrial shows. And I would take the money that I got from building these control boxes and just buy equipment with it, more electronic equipment, oscilloscopes, etc., until I finally filled up my parents' basement with a whole electronic shop. And then at the time my older brother was in medical school, and he would come home on the weekends. And he would start to complain about his problems, like he was studying. He's an MD, PhD, and he was studying pediatric, very serious pediatric problems like leukemia in babies. And he'd come home and he'd say, you know, they make all this great equipment to deliver drugs to patients in a hospital, but all these patients are, you know, adults. And suddenly he had these great ideas on how to use new kinds of drugs to treat these preemies or pediatric patients, but none of the equipment could scale down to deliver these small volumes, and it couldn't fit in isolettes. And I suddenly started thinking that I was, you know, wasting my time building what were then silly devices when I could think about how to help him or make devices that might help these babies live.
So why don't you just list some of the things, some of the medical inventions that you've come up with?
So in those early days, I started building very small pumps to deliver drugs to babies. My brother used them while he was in medical school. We got exposed to a great community of research hospitals, Harvard, Yale. And as a result of getting feedback from different fields of medicine, hematology, oncology, I started building a whole line of miniature wearable pumps, eventually ending up building a wearable pump for diabetics to deliver their insulin a number of years later. And that whole medical company we then sold. We then went on to build other kinds of medical equipment, still in some ways for delivering or measuring fluid. We started building home portable dialysis equipment so people wouldn't have to spend two or three nights a week in a hospital being dialyzed. And we build things like stents, these devices made famous by the fact that Vice President Cheney has one of ours in him, but a small device that goes into the artery that you can get there via a catheter instead of by open heart surgery. And we build the iBot. We've already spoken about that, but that was a device to help the disabled community regain essentially the same capability that people have if they can balance and walk.
Your father was a comic book artist. He did comics for EC Comics and also drew for Mad Magazine. Did he kind of, by example, show you that daydreaming could actually pay off?
You know, people have asked me for most of my adult life why I chose to do what I do, and I have a lot of different answers. It was only a couple of years ago, and I guess due to the notoriety of some of our things, that people like you would say, what impact did your father have on you? And one of them actually answered the question rather than asked it and said, since your father was an entrepreneur, is that why you're an entrepreneur? And I looked right back at her and said, my father's not an entrepreneur. He's an artist. He doesn't know anything about business. My mother teaches bookkeeping in a high school, and as far as I know, she's written every check in their marriage for the last 56 years. My father is an artist. You can't be further from an entrepreneur. And she looked at me and said, well, he was self-employed. He creates things and goes off and presents them to the world, and they either accept them or not. And it literally for the first time occurred to me that I probably in many ways have my perspective on the world due to the influence of my father.
Do you have any favorite comics or Mad Magazine things that your father has done over the years?
I have been collecting now for many years all the original art I can get that he did. And since comics have now become quite a collector's item, it's getting easier to find them. They're more expensive. You can go to Sotheby auctions now and get the originals. The most favorite one I have is the only comic I know that actually turned out to have a context of being about the artist. And it was done by Bill Gaines, then the owner, publisher of EC Comics. And he had asked my father to illustrate a horror story. And the running joke in the industry back then was my father was very good at drawing beautiful women, very sensual, but was terrible at the horror, the blood and guts with the heads ripped off in the comics. He just didn't do that. And the theme of the story, it's only a six-page story, was that it starts out that my father is called into Bill Gaines' office and is fired because he can't make horrible drawings. And he says, oh, yes, I can. And the remaining frames, he goes home to talk to Evelyn, which is my mother's real name, and there she stands with a baby in her arms in one of these frames, and that's my older brother, and or actually my older brother is standing next to her. He's about 4 years old, and I'm in her arms. And for some reason, Bill Gaines used the real names, my mother, who he knew well, us as children, and the story becomes, it comes to a happy ending because it was, in fact, a nightmare. It was done probably in 1953 or 54. I got the original of it. It's called Cayman's Calamity. Calamity spelled with a K. And the original of it was out in California. And I guess it's my favorite because my father was, he never wrote any of the dialogue, any, that's not what he does. He was an illustrator. But this whole thing was written about my father and his capability in art. And I have it hanging in my house right now.
So what are some of the comic series that your father illustrated?
My father was an illustrator for Shock, horror, almost all the suspense stories of EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt, Psycho. He did, I believe, at least one story in every one of the EC series. And he did some Mad Magazine.
Did you read a lot of comics as a kid?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, I never read comics as a kid.
So many kids grew up with parents who thought that comic books were terrible and wanted to throw them out. Here you are growing up with a father who's actually drawing the comic books, and you didn't even read them, right?
Well, I have to tell you, not only did parents think that, but in the early days of McCarthyism, they actually banned comic books.
I know.
And that put my father in jeopardy. In fact, one of the reasons Mad Magazine came to be was Bill Gaines, the owner publisher of EC, suddenly found himself banned from selling his product. And he recognized that they have these kind of web presses and this space in the corner drugstore. What could they do instead of comic books? And Mad Magazine came out of that. And my father, who was an artist for him in the days of EC, then moved into doing that. My mother, of course, then had a pair of twins right after me and quickly decided that my father would be much better off doing serious commercial art than comic books. And he went freelance soon after that and never went back.
Right. Now, in addition to collecting your father's comic books, you collect old machines. Do you take them apart and see how they work?
I certainly do that, but I think you learn a whole lot more about the people than the machines when you look at 100-year-old technology. You look at what they were thinking.
Tell me about a favorite machine in your collection that's led you to interesting thoughts about humans and how they interact with machines.
Well, in almost every case, when you look at machinery from 100 years ago, what you realize is that people were focused on different kinds of issues and they had a different perspective of life. For instance, I have not only a 100-year-old machine, but the owner's manual that came with it. And it's a huge diesel engine. This engine, which happens to be sitting in my house, probably weighs 5,000 pounds. And it turned at such a low speed, you'd actually see the rotating parts work. And yet the bearings were huge. Individual bronze bearings must weigh 10 pounds apiece. And in the front page of the owner's manual, it says something like, "Proper care and attention to your engine will give you and your family generations of reliable service." Now, think of a product you've bought in your lifetime that you would consider something that you intend to give you and your family generations of reliable service. Your computer, by the time you buy it, is obsolete.
Right.
You know, things that we make that are held together by glue or Velcro or plastic flexible hinges, there's almost no product you buy today that will be operative in a few years. People had a very different perspective, so the way they built things were very different. The way they made parts of them accessible were very different. What they wanted the user to know about them were very different. And as you look at the technology, how it was created, what the intended goal was, you realize that there's much more in looking at old machines. And frankly, many of them are just beautiful. They would put curves and shapes in their cast iron castings that were there for nothing but aesthetics at a time when making curves and shapes was much, much more difficult than it is today with computer-controlled equipment. And today, we don't bother to do it. In old machinery, aesthetics was very important.
Now, I've read that you don't sleep very much, and I was wondering whether that was because you can't sleep or you don't want to sleep.
I'm not even sure that it's true that I don't sleep very much. I just tend to be up all night, but I don't get up real early in the morning like a lot of people do, and it was a struggle for me to get here on time today. I would say I go to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning unless something exciting is going on, in which case I might work all night, although these days I'm less capable of doing that than I used to be. But my theory on sleep is you don't go to bed until you're so tired that you know your head's going to hit the pillow and you're out, because thrashing around and wasting time that you could be working is just a bad thing. The problem with that, of course, is if you don't happen to get tired at the right time, you won't go to bed until you're out of sequence with your colleagues. And then if you go to bed at 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning, you're unlikely to be up at 7 when they want to have their 8 o'clock breakfast meeting. I then add to that, to the issue of only go to bed when you're tired, I would add the addendum, and only wake up when nature says it's time. So I hate having an alarm clock. If you're asleep, it's because your body wants to sleep. So it makes scheduling early morning meetings very difficult for me.
Well, thanks for showing up for our 9:30 a.m. interview. One last question. I know you have a private plane. I think you have a private helicopter. You obviously have a Segway or two around. I assume you have a car. Do you know how the planes work? I mean, being this inveterate inventor, do you have to, like, know how the plane works before you like to fly in it?
Oh, for sure. And actually, the main reason I originally got into helicopters is because I was fascinated by the dynamics of a helicopter. And it's, you know, although helicopters and airplanes both fly, they're very, very different kinds of technologies. And in fact, I ended up owning the company that built the helicopter
oh.
that I fly.
sure.
I don't anymore. But I was excited to understand them. And yes, I do a lot to understand the technology. And part of the fun to me of having these machines is the learning experience of staying up with the technology that's in them.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question. Have you actually needed to use any of the medical inventions that you've created?
I personally have not had to use them. Unfortunately, a number of my family members have had to use some of the products we've made. I have to tell you that I've always been excited, and you feel really good when you make a medical product that you know helps people, but I've always felt frustrated that I've never, ever wanted any of my friends or anybody I know to ever have to use my products, the labor of, you know, of my life. And one of the exciting things to us about building the Segway Human Transporter is we're finally building a product that we would actually like other people to want to buy. You know, nobody says, "Dean, that's a great stent. I can't wait until my coronary artery clogs." Or boy, what a neat dialysis machine you've made. I can't wait until my kidneys fail. Nobody has ever said to me, "That iBot is such a neat machine that I'm looking forward to that paralyzing auto accident." So I work very hard in the medical product area. And I go to bed always feeling really good when you know it works and you're helping people. But it's a whole different story than just watching people light up when you let them try the Segway Human Transporter.
Dean Kamen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dean Kamen invented many medical innovations as well as the Segway Human Transporter.